This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And if at first you don't succeed, you know how the saying goes, try again. And there could be a link there. Here's a poem, Try Again by William Edward Hickson. If you find your task is hard, try again. Time will bring you your reward, try again. All that other folks can do, why with patience should not you? Only keep this rule in view, try again. Time will bring you your reward for continuing to do an activity that you may not be that great at. But what are our options when we begin but fail, strive but fall short, give up, try something else? What's really in it for us to persevere? We want to hear from you this half hour at 1-800-642-1234. Does this sound like you? Have you recently tried something new, a new sport, a new activity, a hobby, and how did you find it? Were you a master of your craft right out of the gate, or did you strike out like the Brewers did this season? Any backup? Give it another go? You tell me how it went for you at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest is Rachel Feinzig. She is the work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and she recently wrote an amazing article about all of this in a column for the journal called The Case for Allowing Yourself to Be Bad at Something. Rachel, thank you for allowing me to be bad at so many things.
Thank you so much for having me. I could spend the whole half hour just talking about all the things I'm bad at.
Right, that's what I was thinking. Is I'm going to have to refrain, and we'll just give out the phone number again and hope others will participate and let us know what they're not so good at 1-800-642-1234. Please, you tell us so we don't have to tell you. And Rachel, what inspired you to write this column?
So I was at a yoga class with a colleague and friend this past summer. I am a runner and I got injured. So I was like that girl, you know, that injured runner in the yoga class trying to fit in with all the experienced yogis. I am so bad at yoga. And I said to my friend, like, I hope after the class, I hope you weren't watching me. And she told me two things. One, no, I wasn't watching you. Like, I don't care, which I think is an important takeaway for all of this. But the second thing she said was, you know, my husband won't even come to yoga with me. He won't do anything that he's not great at. And I just immediately knew I had to write a column about this and why we are so bad at being bad at things.
Well, and how do you get good if you're not bad at it first? And maybe that says more about me than anything else, Rachel, but I certainly had to wonder when I read your article, how does anybody start out of the gate being so brilliant and being able to dance so well? Doesn't
completely
happen, does it?
No. And I recounted my yoga story to someone that I talked to for the story. She's actually a professional mountain biker. And her response was like, what did you expect was going to happen to you at yoga class? Like, people spend years trying to master this stuff. And it often comes with periods of getting worse or staying stagnant. Like, progress is not linear and doesn't come in this kind of like lockstep, you know, way that we expect. And so, yes, I think you're completely right. It's totally normal to be bad at something, especially at first.
Rachel Feinzig from the Wall Street Journal looked into this for us, and I believe at some level we could all relate. What are you bad at? 1-800-642-1234. And Rachel, as you write in the Wall Street Journal, that you heard more profanity while interviewing for this story than you did when you actually did a story about profanity.
I was so quiet. I could not believe how upset and like deeply emotionally affected people were as they told me these stories about their failings, about things, you know, that oftentimes were like fairly inconsequential, just in the sense that they were hobbies, things they were doing for pleasure, not like I have messed up this massive part of my life. And yet they were just torn and tortured about it, really.
And it feels that way, and it sounded that way from the interviews and the curse words you couldn't use for your story, Rachel. But it goes towards, and you write about this, social perfectionism, the trend of social perfectionism, that we have to be great. There is no room for error here. But those trends are changing, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I felt like really made this an important story to tell right now. This idea that all of us have become more perfectionistic over the years. There is research that's been done on this, analyzing students. We all fall somewhere on this kind of scale of perfectionism, and the average is just shifting more to the right, more toward that kind of no tolerance for failure, obsessed with how other people are perceiving us. This idea, they call it social perfectionism. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons for it that we can talk about, but I think it makes a story like this just way more pertinent in this moment.
So you are way out of balance at a yoga class and you think everybody is looking at you, even though they're doing the downward dog. So couldn't even see you unless they were doing the position incorrectly. But there is this sense that, oh my gosh, everybody's looking at me. And the reality is everybody's kind of thinking about that themselves, aren't they? That you're not on a stage.
Oh, completely. And we're all just totally self-obsessed as humans. I know you didn't mean that in like a bad way, but you know, we're worried about how we look as compared to kind of picking apart other people, especially in a situation like this where it's just a yoga class. Like, I wanted to talk to people about all parts of their lives. And certainly some of it was about work, but some of it was just about this kind of plethora of hobbies that people have or side interests. And it was just fascinating to see how people thought about being watched and being viewed.
Mm-hmm. So right now, I want to know what you're bad at. Or if you don't think you're bad at anything, I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Rachel Feinzig, who is the work and life columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Let's go to Marcia in Stevens Point this afternoon. Marcia, you're on Central Time.
Yes, I'd just like to tell you that I don't consider I'm bad at anything because I do not have an inner critic.
Well, what's that like?
Well, it's fabulous because I don't have to feel bad all the time.
So dancing, singing, it doesn't matter. Ice fishing, there's no way. I mean, you're good at it, or you just don't have anybody telling you that it doesn't matter.
I never considered it matter. If I have fun doing something, what's the difference whether I'm doing it as good as the next person?
If you're having fun doing something, who cares how good you are at it? Rachel, that really resonates with me.
I love that. We should all, me especially, Marcia's my new therapist. What a great advice.
Exactly. And so as I think of this, how do you get rid of that inner critic? Marcia doesn't seem to have ever had it, which I would think might be a blessing and a curse, but how do you shake it?
I think part of it is just embracing the fact that you're a beginner, like telling yourself, reminding yourself that people like helping beginners. It just being kind of honest about it and asking for help can make other people feel like they're the experts.
Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And going back to the idea that everybody's watching you talked to a business owner, Elliot Pepper, for your story in the Wall Street Journal, and he had some glaring discrepancies. There were some things he was not great at, but he didn't want to admit it, and it cost him, at least business-wise, on his bottom line. Once he realized that he was able to fill the gaps and do so, his quote was, "People don't care that much." People don't care that much, Rachel.
I know. I love that quote. And I thought it was a really fascinating example because he would go to these networking events for entrepreneurs, you know, where people kind of offer helpful tips and people would ask, you know, how's he doing? And he would just,
great.
He'd just say, I'm killing it. I'm like, he couldn't, you know, admit his failings, which were not really about like the substance of his business. He's an accountant and a financial planner, and he knew the ins and outs of all these complicated things, but he couldn't handle things like, you know, collecting on invoices. And so, you know, for him, the answer came from finding a business partner who was A, good at the things he wasn't good at, and B, who he felt comfortable opening up to and learning from. And that kind of just solved the problem.
Let's go to Pat in Green Bay with things we're not so great at and why that might not matter at 1-800-642-1234. Pat, good afternoon.
Afternoon, folks. Thank you for accepting my phone call.
Thanks for calling. What do you got?
All right. So my thing that I am just horrible at is reading people.
That's got to be rough, Pat.
Well, okay, to put it in context, I have, as I like to call it, my side hustle. I'm practicing for retirement. I create wooden wares, so wooden spoons, you know, utensils, mm-hmm. things like that. So I'm always trying to look in the magic crystal ball of what do people want next year? Well, I've been doing this for three years. I still don't have it right.
Well, Well, it's just 3 years, Pat. I think you got to give it 30. And even after that, how, I mean, human behavior, that you've really, who would be very good at that, Pat? I would be interested to meet the person who would be very good at that. Rachel, so great with wooden wares, but not easy to figure out what wooden wares people are going to want.
I mean, it reminds me of the Elliot Pepper story, right? Where you're good at doing the thing and you and there's this other skill set that's not really central to the doing of the thing that you're missing. So I feel like it's something where you could, you know, just ask someone else for help. And I also think it just goes back to the point of like you said, it's only been 3 years. Everything takes longer than we think it will to get right. It's been my experience.
Rachel Feinzig, that has been mine as well. She is our guest and a work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, discussing how bad people are at being bad at things. We should get better at being bad, is what we're saying. We don't like it. Rachel's found, and she's here to tell us, keep on trying that thing anyway, especially if it's fun. As Marcia pointed out, if it's fun, what's the point of the rest, right? 1-800-642-1234, your chance to share with us what you're so bad at. Why that just doesn't matter. We'll continue the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our talk with Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist for The Wall Street Journal, talking about a recent column of hers for the journal titled "The Case for Allowing Yourself to Be Bad at Something." And it turns out we're just not that good at being bad. And we're looking for your input this afternoon on what you're bad at and why that might not matter at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Where Jeff and Superior are standing by. Jeff, what are you bad at?
Good afternoon. I'm 62 years old, and I've spent a lot of money in my lifetime trying to become good at carving pumpkins.
Like just the nose and the eyes, or the elaborate three? Yeah.
You know, those young women in their 20s and 30s, they're so effortless. You know, they can do it for the kids. But I don't have that flair, that intuition, or that whatever je ne sais quoi they have. But they seem to do, their pumpkins are perfect. And I destroy a pumpkin when I try to make it, I try to carve it. And I feel sorry for the pumpkin, but I keep trying.
Now, is this something you only do during Halloween season, or is this a year-round practice that you've developed until you put in the hours to become good at it?
Oh, I'm still not good at it. I've put in hours. I've lived in community. I've lived with people. I've even tried to bring this privately so I'm not embarrassing myself.
Wow.
But I keep trying to make a pumpkin that I can say, doggone it, that's a darn good pumpkin.
Well, wrong time of year to be terrible at pumpkin carving, Jeff, but I very much appreciate the call. And Rachel Feinzig, it's interesting because sometimes being great at something isn't that great. And you talk to a pro BMX biker about what it means to be perfect at being a BMX biker. And it just didn't seem, at least for the person that you interviewed, to be fun.
I think it can take a lot of the fun out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, he told me, you know, for him now, because he decided not to go that route of being a professional BMX biker, you do a trick one time, you do it and you enjoy it. And being a professional, you have to do it 100 times until there's no possible way that you could not get it right. And I mean, it wears on people. He found that it was much more sustainable to just keep it as a hobby versus risking injury. He found that a lot of professional BMXers had trouble with money and addiction. And I think there's a sense that keeping something fun oftentimes means not obsessing over perfecting it.
Mm-hmm. You do it so often that it's muscle memory, that you could do it in your sleep. And once you're doing it in your sleep, where's the fun in that?
I mean, it becomes a job, right? A reason you get paid for jobs. No matter how great they are, they're still not that fun.
Let's turn now to Paul in Northern Illinois. Paul, you're on Central Time with Rachel Feinzig.
Hi, you've inspired me to pivot just a hair, even though my main thing is yet to come. My dad was a professional drummer, played for Frank Sinatra of the Rat Pack. And when I was a young teen aspiring to be just like him, he said, don't do it. You're going to discover that the music business is just going to eat you alive and it won't make you happy. So I keep drums as a hobby.
Yeah.
And I agree with that previous statement. But my thing that I'm really bad at is reading a room. And I feel like my mission in life is to build bridges and connect people. So I don't mind if I kind of play the fool sometimes in order for people to either get a laugh at my expense or just connect.
So, and this is the second time we've heard this, Paul, and and I can relate to it too. Sometimes it's difficult to relate to people. It's tough to know what they want or where they want to go with it. And sometimes it's not easy to read a room. Rachel, we've heard this a couple times now, and it's an interesting take on and a little bit different than your article.
Right, this idea that people are an enigma. I mean, I think it's true, and I think it's probably especially true in this moment after the pandemic, right? I think a lot of people are probably feeling like they have trouble reading a room or connecting to people in the right way or not being awkward, you know, as we kind of like totally gear up and go back to, you know, some semblance of what things were like in 2019.
And I want to go back to a moment, this idea that we don't like being bad at something because we have this sense that we're being watched or that there is an audience. And I wonder if we were bad at something and there was an audience, whether or not there'd be a change in society. If there was, you know, I am a bad dancer. And so if I were to bad dance in front of anybody, whether or not that would make it a little bit easier for all the other bad dancers in the world to shake their tail feather.
Oh, totally. I can't remember who, but someone I was talking to for the piece was like, is there anything better than watching someone just leave it all out on the dance floor? Especially when they're just doing their own thing and it's not like they're some professionally trained like ballroom dancer. I think it leaves room for way more like joy and it gives other people permission to just be themselves. And one other benefit that we haven't talked about yet, but that I heard from a surfer who I talked to for this piece was, you know, in so many parts of our lives, we have to be the leader, the one who's helping other people. She talked about how freeing it was to not have to be good at surfing, to not feel that pressure. It's just can be really liberating.
And we put this up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked people about the stuff they tried and were bad at it and what happened. We got a response from Pete who said, I took guitar lessons earlier this year, started off great, but once we got into chords, I struggled. Wasn't putting in the practice time I needed, and then when the summer came, I said I was too busy to continue the lessons, but I wish I had learned guitar. And Pete got a supportive response from Paul on Facebook who says, get back to the guitar, guy. Chords are not that bad if just learn the basic ones. He says, I struggled too, but my daughter encouraged me to get back at it. And now I play in jam bands on Saturdays. Well, get back at it. And you know what's interesting? I've tried to play guitar too. And the one thing I realized is it hurts. You need calluses to do that. So right out of the gate, it's not something you're going to be good at no matter what. But there is this sense that, you know, if you stick with it, you'll be at least good enough to not have to hide it. Right?
Well, yeah. And I also think that there oftentimes does have to be a certain level of being good at something to have it be enjoyable. So to reach that, like, you know, something of a flow state where you feel like you're doing it, like the surfer that I talked to, I mean, ideally, like to get up on a wave, you know, is like this exhilarating feeling, or to be good enough in the water that you can paddle out and be there experiencing it. So, I mean, I'm all for being bad at things too, but I do understand this idea that, you know, I think that for me, if I was just better at yoga, I could do more of the poses and I would be in more of like a flow state, you know, during the class.
So have you gotten back to yoga, Rachel?
No, I totally have given up and just gone back to running. I it's true. I ran away from the yoga as I could.
I've given up on guitar too, and it turns out I'll just have soft fingers and that'll be the way it's going to be. But since you published your story in the Wall Street Journal, what kind of feedback have you received? Have you heard more bad stuff?
Yes, golf has been a big theme for people. A lot of people feeling bad about their golf game. All kinds of things that I haven't even thought of. People have told me about their hobbies, things that they ditched, and then things that they, you know, pursued and eventually got great at. You know, I think photography was mentioned. It's been fascinating to hear people's. I really feel like it goes to the heart of how we feel about ourselves as humans.
Yeah, and I feel there's like a Venn diagram here somewhere where if we're bad at a thing but we enjoy the thing, it's a good idea to keep doing it. But if we're bad at it and don't like it, then we don't need to keep doing it at all. And should we keep doing it and holding out for something to turn around? What do you think?
I think only if you really want to. I think, like I said, reaching that flow state, if it's something where you really think the payoff is going to be there, like some things just are kind of miserable to learn. Snowboarding, for example, you are like on your butt and it is cold and it costs a lot of money. But I think you do, if it's something that's important to you, that you really feel in your gut that you've always wanted to do. And I heard that from a lot of people. I heard that from so many people. I always wanted to do this. And only now that I'm like 70 years old and in retirement, did I give it a go. And it's as great as I thought. It's like, don't wait until retirement, you know?
Right. Rachel, I would ask you, what advice would you give for someone who's struggling either with a new skill or an old skill or something that they've left behind but still think about and considering giving it up or picking it up? But again, what would you say to them?
I would set a timeline and just totally embrace the fact that you're going to be bad for the first like X period of time. Give yourself, if it's snowboarding, like give yourself X number of lessons, and you know you're going to be bad, and you're going to go in there to the instructor and say like, I'm bad, but not in like a self-deprecating, like, you know, like fishing for compliments way, in like a, I invite your help and expertise kind of way. And I so appreciate like what you can do, your talents. I think that having that attitude for a set period of time is a good way to go.
Rachel Feinzig, thank you for making us feel that bad can be so good.
Thank you so much for having me.
Work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, picture the scene, a small group of eccentric creative types work in a decrepit building and come up with an innovative product that sweeps the world, earning millions of dollars. The company sees ups and downs, takeovers, and drama, but that product ushers in a new era. Is it Silicon Valley? Seattle? No, it's Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in the 1970s. The product? A new kind of game called Dungeons & Dragons. Here's a game of D&D in action in the Netflix hit series Stranger Things.
The hooded cultists chant, "Hail, Lord Vecna. Hail, Lord Vecna." They turn to you, remove their hoods. You recognize most of them from Mokbar. There is one you do not recognize. His skin, shriveled, desiccated. Something else. He is not only missing his left arm, but his left eye.
Vecna's dead.
He killed my cat.
So it was thought, my friends. So it was thought. But Vecna lives.
Vecna lives, and so does Dungeons & Dragons. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of the rise and fall of TSR, the Lake Geneva company that made Dungeons & Dragons, and the buyout that kept the game alive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now, or have you ever been a D&D player? Were your kids, your grandkids, were you there at Ground Zero? Maybe even in Lake Geneva yourself? Did you play in the early days? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee, where he teaches English and history. He's the host of a role-playing game podcast called Plot Points, and his new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons & Dragons. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. It's a dream to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Fantastic. Well, glad to have you. Now, you tell the story not just of the creative side of the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, but also the business side. And this was, TSR was in the business papers, you write. What made you want to dig into that side of the story?
So it was a story that demanded to be told. About 6 years ago, I was writing for Geek & Sundry, and I was assigned an article tentatively titled, "Did you know that Dungeons and Dragons wasn't always made in Seattle?" And being in Wisconsin and knowing a bunch of the old hands back here, I was given the job of writing that article. And as I worked on it, one article became three articles, and people started sending me documents in the mail asking to be confidential. I got interviews with people no one had talked to before. So the writing stretched out over 6 years, and I was like, if I don't write this, no one will. And it's a piece of Wisconsin history that has not yet seen the light of day. So it's been a pleasure to write, and I'm really glad that people are reacting so positively to the book.
Take us back to the origin here. We've got this really in Lake Geneva, this local eccentric, as you describe him, Gary Gygax, go from, you know, an out of work cobbler at some points to the creator of this new kind of game.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that Gary Gygax is the most influential Wisconsinite in our state's history. And yet, nobody really talks about him much. Lake Geneva doesn't even have a statue to him. He was an unemployed insurance underwriter fixing shoes in his children's basement, who was designing wargaming rules for fun. And one of his kids told me, you know, he only made enough money from that to like take the family out to dinner once or twice. Then a guy comes down from Minnesota, Dave Arneson, and he shows Gary Gygax what he did with one of his war games, a war game called Chainmail. And Dave Arneson took that game and he used it to, he gave players a single character, which was new. They were exploring a dungeon, and these characters persisted from game session to game session and increased in power as they went along. And Gary Gygax was like, holy cow, this is amazing. Dave Arneson, give me all the rules to this game. So Dave Arneson sent him between 18 and 24 cribbed and cramped pages. Gary Gygax took that and set about making it into a rule set that would be called Dungeons and Dragons. But again, what he created was so radical, so new, we're still grappling with it today. It's like someone invented acting in 1974. Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson found something new to do with pencils, papers, and your brain that no one thought of before. So again, it's one of the reasons that people oftentimes grapple with explaining how to play D&D and what D&D is. But Wisconsin saw the birth of a totally new medium, one in which the player is like the actor and audience at the same time. Again, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin really is a mecca. And again, I feel like we don't appreciate it properly within the state. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. And now this company, TSR, Tactical Studies Rules, it stands for, they end up having this multi-million dollar product. Can you talk about how it went from that germ of an idea to this thing that really just swept the country, including to a young fella named Rob, just coming out of elementary school, if I could age myself?
So yeah, the growth of the game was exponential. Tactical Studies Rules, TSR, was founded because no other company would publish the rules. They just didn't see what the market for it was going to be. But the ability to take one character and control them and do anything was addictive. I want to say the first 1,000 copies sold out in a little under a year. The second 1,000 copies sold out in like 5 or 6 months. And it really saw exponential growth through 1983, as I recall. Again, it was slowed by the fact that it is really hard to explain how to play, but it's very easy to watch someone play and be like, oh, that's what you do in a role-playing mm-hmm. game. It's why role-playing games have really taken off now in the 21st century, because YouTube allows you to watch people play all day long, and that's the best way to learn how to play. But the fact that D&D was so new and such an innovation, that really drove that first burst of growth through the early 80s. And then there was a crisis, and Gary Gygax lost control of D&D and the company, and the game was purchased by a woman named Lorraine Williams, who oversaw the company's silver age through 1997, when it was finally purchased by Magic the Gathering creators Wizards of the Coast, and took the game out to Seattle, and Wisconsin lost a jewel, sadly, although the Wizards of the Coast, I think, has done a very good job with it. Did that make sense?
Yeah, we're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about a big piece of Wisconsin history. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the invention of a whole genre of games called role-playing game that ended up being influential in lots of other stuff, including computer games. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of the game, what it is, how it works? Are you part of that history? Do you play it now? Did you maybe years ago? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben, as you mentioned, there was kind of well, there have been multiple crisis periods in the history of the game and of TSR. It seems like one problem was they'd come up with this product. They made lots of money at it. None of them really knew a lot about how to run a business, though, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, at TSR, initially you had, again, Gary Gygax was an insurance underwriter and cobbler. You had a pharmacist, you had a pipe fitter, and they were running the company. And, you know, life is well and good when your product is growing exponentially. And then when Lorraine Williams took over, again, she'd worked in business, but her degree was not in business. And she did hire business people, but she tended to hire, you know, like people from the cardboard industry are suddenly working at TSR dealing with artists and writers. You had one executive come down to Brahm, a genius artist who would create these gloomy landscapes and these intriguing, mysterious characters, you know, but tended to be fairly monochrome. And this executive says to Brahm, now make sure you use all your colors in this painting because it's important, and which is a bit like telling Shakespeare to use more words. So there definitely was a gap between the business ability of the people running the company and perhaps what it should have been. Role-playing games are also a difficult business. You know, mm-hmm. If you drink a bottle of Miller, if you want more Miller, you have to go buy more. If you spent $30 on Dungeons & Dragons rule books in 1979, you could still be playing with them today and never would have needed anything else. The fact that, you know, this is an evergreen product that never goes bad causes real problems for role-playing game companies, because after you sell it to them once, what do you do? And Dungeons & Dragons has tried to come up with new editions and use that as an engine of growth for the game. And the current edition, 5th edition, is apparently a huge hit. I don't have sales numbers for it, but the Player's Handbook came out 8 years ago, and it's still in like the top 50 sellers on Amazon today. That's crazy. Wizards of the Coast claims that they've had 50 million people experience the game, even if that means 25 million people have played it. That's tremendous growth. Like I would say that when the game was in Wisconsin, it probably maxed out around 2 million players. So it's grown exponentially since it left the state.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Elgin. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. You're talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and I remember around Halloween of 1985, I worked at a club in Chicago called Limelight. And at the Halloween party, I met a guy, and it was a costume party, dressed like a vampire, asked me to go out for dinner, and I said yes. And on the way home, I realized I have no idea what this guy looks like when he shows up at the door. Well, it turns out he worked for TSR. He knew that I had a young son. And he brought with him, I guess, to curry points with me, every single thing that TSR had put out up until that point. And, I mean, the stuff just kept coming up to the door, box after box after box of stuff. And my son was, like, the hit of the neighborhood for, I don't even remember how every kid in the world ended up at my house, which I'd rather have than him going wherever they would go. And, yes, now he's 50 years old, and he has actually moved out of my basement. He doesn't still live down in the basement playing D&D.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for sharing that story. It's a great story. I don't exactly remember D&D in the 80s being the ticket to popularity, Ben, but it has changed in some ways from being this really niche nerd thing to a lot more people play it than that original core audience.
You know, I hope this might sound silly, you know, I teach 7th and 8th grade, and it was about a year ago, I wandered into the teacher's lounge, and it was filled with women under 30 talking about their D&D campaigns. and again, for me, as a white guy in my 40s, where role-playing games were pretty white and pretty male, it blew my mind. I would honestly tell you, as popular as role-playing games have become, indications are that it's even the rate of increase in players is about to go vertical. The speed of increase seems to be picking up, not slowing down, which again is crazy to think about. You know, when you think about how nerdy and niche role-playing games were in the 80s and 90s, you know, you feel glad that they're even talking about them on TV shows. But the fact that, again, I honestly believe that we're about to see a multiple of the number of people currently playing start playing, that is my prediction. Did that make sense?
Sure. Thanks for that call. We're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. It tells the story of TSR, the Lake Geneva company behind the famous role-playing game. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of Dungeons and Dragons or what the heck it is? Have you played it over the last year, over the last five decades? Do you have a memory you want to share? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ben Riggs. He's from Milwaukee. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. You can join in with your memories, your questions at 800-642-1234. Memories from five decades ago or from a session last night. Rick joins us now in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to let you know that, yes, I did buy the book and I have started reading it. I've only gotten through the first chapter, but so far it's great.
Thanks, Rick.
Secondly, I used to play back in the day, late 70s, early 80s, you know, junior high, high school. And it was fun then, but it was a little harder to play because you had to make everything up yourself. You're playing there in your head with the rule book, a notebook, and graph paper. Nowadays, I've started playing again due to my daughter getting into it, and now my granddaughter is really getting into it. So we've started playing it again with the fifth edition stuff, and they've made it so much easier with all of the pre-written campaigns to go on. There's pre-written, pre-planned single-shot games where it, you know, you come in with a brand-new character, play for 2 hours, you know, do one adventure and then you're done, or you can continue those characters on to other adventures. You know,
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing the love that you're playing a multi-generational D&D there. Ben, what do you think?
I think that that intergenerational experience is becoming happily common. Again, like it's something that, you know, my parents never really understood, but now it does seem to be a thing that you and your kids can do together. I have an 18-month-old and one of my friends was like, oh, only 10 years until you have a new player in your D&D campaign. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's true. Also, again, there has been a huge proliferation of materials for Dungeons & Dragons. Wizards of the Coast did something radical with the D&D intellectual property about 22 years ago, and they opened it up. Essentially, anyone who wants to can make their own D&D rulebooks, can make their own D&D settings, put them up for sale on the internet, and make money off them and not have to send Wizards of the Coast a dime. And the result of that really has been an incredible richness of settings and adventures and options for Dungeons & Dragons players. It may be, again, one of the reasons that you're seeing this exponential growth in players is that the IP is open. You know, it'd be like Disney saying anybody can make a Star Wars movie. It's crazy.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Dan in West Salem who emailed about, it wasn't just TSR, but it was also the gaming convention Gen Con that got really huge in Lake Geneva until it was finally moved, I think, to Indianapolis at some point. That was a big part of the story of Wisconsin's role in gaming, though, Ben.
Oh, it's amazing. Gary Gygax also started Gen Con. You know, like, again, if you're looking for a reason to call Gary Gygax the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, he didn't only create a radical new medium. He created the largest tabletop and role-playing game convention in North America. It moved out of Lake Geneva to UW campuses. I forget which ones. Then it settled in Milwaukee for a good long time. And then when Wizards of the Coast bought Dungeons and Dragons, they ended up moving it to Indianapolis. And Indianapolis does do a really good job with it. Again, I feel like, you know, I'm a Milwaukeean. I went to Gen Con in Milwaukee. Indianapolis does a better job with the convention than we did. Again, it feels like Dungeons and Dragons, TSR, all of that has always been something that the state is more ashamed of than proud of. And I think it's one of the reasons we lost that convention.
Let's go back to our callers now. Valerie is with us in Milwaukee. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What you want to tell us about?
Sure. So I'm 30, and I've wanted to play D&D for a long time, but I was always kind of intimidated by it. And I have been watching a lot more web programs like Dimension 20 and Critical Role, where you can watch people playing these really long, wonderfully creative campaigns. And I think it's great to make it more accessible. And I just started playing my own campaign a few months ago, and I just want to kind of bring up that new exciting aspect of it.
Valerie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ben, yeah, there are a lot of things where you can watch other people playing D&D and other role-playing games.
Yeah, about huzzah for you, Valerie. About 14 years ago, I thought tabletop role-playing games were dead. I went and bought everything I wanted. I put it in my basement, and I thought, role-playing games are done. They've been killed by video games and the recession, and it's over now. People will look at it the way they look at pet rocks. But I could not have been more wrong. Both video games and the internet have been fantastic for tabletop role-playing games. Video games essentially teach you how to play role-playing games because they stole so much from Dungeons and Dragons, hit points, levels. And YouTube, which again, I thought people would be on there watching pirated South Park or something. Instead, YouTube is a gigantic engine for teaching people how to play Dungeons and Dragons with the best imaginable teachers, with voice actors and comedians playing the game, making it look just amazing. Not only that, but tabletop role-playing game has something that electronics do not have, which is just you have to gather with other human beings and experience the animal warmth of your fellows, which again, when we're online all day with Zoom, when we are just engaging more and more electronically, being able to get together with people and to have to get together with them to play this game, it's just a tonic and antidote to all of that.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, there is an effort to establish that statue that isn't there in Lake Geneva, I think, for Gary Gygax. What are you hoping for to get Wisconsin to recognize this part of its history?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say we could start with Governor Evers officially recognizing Gary Gygax Day, which just recently passed. Because, hey, again, if he's the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, we should at least take one day of the year and make it an official holiday here in Wisconsin. So that is what I will push for, sir, making Gary Gygax Day an official holiday in the state of Wisconsin.
All right, roll 20, difficulty 15 to make that happen, Ben. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I'll be anytime you want me on. Oh, and if you're really interested in D&D, you can see D&D sales numbers on my Twitter page. It's at @BenRiggs_.
Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the origins of this incredibly influential new kind of game. Got its start in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He tracks the twists and turns both on the creative side and the business side of things.